Well, hello. My name is Angele Wood, and this is Crime of the Truest Kind. Thank you to everyone who came to Faces Brewing in Malden for our live show. I have just gotten some audio and video that I have not reviewed, but if it is decent, I will share it in the feed. Thank you to Emily Sweeney from the Boston Globe Cold Case Files. Thank you to all of you who showed up. Some of whom had never heard the podcast before, so I hope you've listened. This is going to be a long episode, and here's why. Episodes 57 and 58 have been about towns in Massachusetts and Pepperell, Massachusetts, two major happenings in 1986 and 1987. The perpetrator in these cases is a teenager named Daniel LaPlante, who has been arrested, charged, convicted, and is in prison for these crimes. But what isn't known is the real story, particularly to what went down at the Bowens house in Pepperell, Massachusetts in 1986. There's so much misinformation online about this case, and there's a lot of reasons for that, which we will talk about. I spoke to author Joe Turner, who I talked to you about in the last episode. He has written the book, The Boy in the Walls, due out at some point. It has been delayed to no fault of author Joe Turner. The book is about the Daniel LaPlante cases from 1986 and 87 in Townsend and Pepperell, Massachusetts, two small towns on the New Hampshire border. Now, I've heard people say, outside Boston, when referring to these towns and their location, yeah, about 50 miles outside Boston. I spoke to Joe Turner, who has been researching this case and has spoken to the Bowen girls, now women, Tina, Kathy, and Karen. He has spoken to members of the LaPlante family, friends from Townsend, all of whom have never really discussed Daniel or these cases from the last 35 plus years. I needed to clear some things up, and I have learned a lot. In this episode, episode 59, we will discuss graphic topics: murder, sexual assault, stalking, something we now call frogging. But in 1986, a teenage boy was hiding in a crawl space in someone's house for months. And there's a lot going on here. We learn about Daniel LaPlante's paternity. We learn very dark things about the man he called his father. We learn the real story about Daniel's reported sexual abuse, what really happened in the walls of the Bowen home over the course of several months in 1986. And I learned for the first time what connection Andrew Gustafson had with a young Daniel LaPlante prior to his family's murder in 1987. We had a very long conversation, more than 2 hours, and he's in the UK, so it was likely edging into the middle of the night for him. We have a lot of ground to cover. But before I do that, I want to remind you, Thursday, March 7th, my next live show, Off Cabot, Beverly, Massachusetts. I don't really have a proper title for this episode. AI would probably say, Separating Facts from Fiction in the Dark Story of Daniel LaPlante in a Small Massachusetts Town, or something like that. I want to thank Joe Turner for his time. His website is joeturnerbooks.com. He does plan a trip to the U.S., and if he does, we'll do a show. So get a snack, go to the bathroom, get another cup of coffee. This is a long one. how did you get on this? I know there's a couple of New England cases that you've been really paying a lot of attention to. How did you learn about Daniel LaPlante, for starters?
It's quite strange. I first learned about the case a long time ago. I'm talking like 15 years ago. I remember reading little snippets about it back in the day on forums. And about 7 years ago, I was writing for a website, a true crime website. And the editor just let me write about whatever I wanted, any cases that I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I always had the LaPlante case in the back of my mind back then. And so I thought, oh, no, I'll cover that story because there's not many sources about it. So I'll cover that story based on all the sources I could find online and the one documentary that had been made about it. So I wrote up like a definitive, the most comprehensive online source of the case, put it on this website. And then I just forgot about it. I thought, that's it, really. But somehow the article made its way to the people of Townsend and Pepperell. And then I was contacted by a bunch of people that were close to the case. Like I was contacted by the police officers that arrested Dan's old friends, some of his old teachers, some of the victims. And they all sort of reached out to me and said, oh, I've got a insight into this story. Do you want to hear it? And at the time, I wasn't that invested in the story because I wasn't too close to it. And then the more I heard their stories, the more I was like, okay, this is a lot different to what is reported everywhere else. And it was weird because everybody involved in the story thought that only their part of the case had been like embellished or missed out, but really everyone's part of the story was missing, certain elements that were never reported and stuff. And I put it all together and it became this huge thing that was just completely different from what was reported elsewhere. And I thought, okay, I've really got something here. And then as I dug deeper in, I made friends with a lot of people. I'm like a lot of Dan's old friends are now my friends. I'm really close to the victims that he stalked, the Bowen girls. I talk to them all the time. Some of the officers that arrested him. And it's like I felt a sort of a kinship with them, and I felt a duty that they were nice enough to share these horrific details with me. So I felt I had a duty to honor them and put them in a format where where we could all process them in a real non-exploitative format, And I wanted to do it for them because it was for them. It felt like an exorcism too, I believe. Like the amount of people that said to me, oh, I haven't spoken about this in 30 years. There must have been 10, 20 people that said that. So I felt like it was the right thing to do, put it in a book, put it out there and, give them a sense of closure in a way.
Any amount of researching, Googling, etc., is so confounding, and I'm sure you found all of that at the start of this. To put it in a timeline, so I started with the Townsend case with the Gustafson family, and then, of course, we know that there's the prequel, if you will, with the Bowen family that sort of led up to the events of what happened with the Gustafson family. Why is the information so convoluted? Does it start with the fact that the families, at least the girls involved, were minors? Is that where it begins? Why it's so convoluted and so difficult to find factual information?
Well, I don't think it does start with the bones. I think it started with the press at the time, because I've got articles from 1986 when it was all reported, but it was reported they couldn't mention the girls' names at the time because they were all minors. So it was like a local girl, a local family. And even then, from 1986, the details were still very distorted at the time. Like the first chapter of my book, I point out that one newspaper said Dan was dressed as a native Indian. The exact same day, another newspaper reported that he was dressed as a ninja. And then the exact same day, someone reported that he was dressed with a different kind of face paint on. So they started right from the beginning. So immediately they didn't have a solid foundation for facts. How that happened, I don't know. I'm guessing it's just a word of mouth from around the police precinct. I'm guessing individual officers heard things from the officers that arrested Dan. And then he got passed through, down the line, broken telephone, I guess. And then journalists just reported whatever they heard. And I'm guessing it started that way. The Bowen family did speak to the press once or twice, but I don't think they lied about anything. I think they told all the facts that they could remember. Now, we have to remember that they were 16, 15, and 9 years old. So their memories might not have been as, you know, solid as the 30-year-olds. Even today, they still remember the facts as it was 36 years ago. So I don't think they lied at all. I'm guessing it's just a case of miscommunication, or at worst, journalists just trying to spice things up, just trying to add a little bit of flavor to the proceedings, because, you know, back in the 80s, it wasn't as regulated as it is today, so people could just say whatever they wanted. And also, there's the element that Townsend and Pepperell are small towns. You know, every gossip is everybody's business. And there's a chance that some of the journalists just spoke to that guy down the road, the guy that knows a guy that knows the Bowens, and he heard that, oh, damn, there's an injury in the closet. And, you know, could have just been that. That's my personal theory. I don't know 100% where it all came from, but that's how it started. And then, and weirdly, over the years, it just got worse. Like, there's just been more and more misinformation coming out. And honestly, I don't know where that stuff come from, because the Bowens never spoke about it till recently. Again, I assume it's just people from Townsend, people that kind of knew, had heard of the case, or knew a guy that knew a guy that knew Dan, and he heard this happened in one of the houses and he just came from there. So yeah, it's a real fertile ground for just lies.
It's extraordinary. And, you know, I'm not too terribly far away from this area, and I realize how small and rural that it is. And I'm always looking at maps and seeing the distances, and, you know, West Elm Street to Saunders Road and et cetera. And then looking at the distance from where Daniel LaPlante actually lived to where the Bowens house was, it was really far away. So was he walking back and forth? Like, I have so many questions about how this played out. Even some of these little questions, like, did you ever learn how Daniel LaPlante was getting back and forth to the Bowens home, and how long? Because he was there for a considerable amount of time, it was determined, right?
Yeah. First question, he was getting there by bike, usually. It was 8 miles, and then it was 8 miles of, it wasn't like a, it was mostly a straight road from Dan's house to the Bowens house in Pepperell, Townsend of Pepperell. There was one main street, you know, goes all the way through both towns. And Dan was mostly getting there by bike. But of course, Dan wasn't, he didn't go home every night. Like, he didn't go in the Bowens house, then go home. Sometimes he'd stay around, he'd stay with friends, he'd sleep rough, stuff like that. And there were a few other there was a couple of houses nearby the Bowen house that were in mid-construction. Like, a couple of wealthy families were building their own houses, and he used to hide out in there because there was no builders there at night. It was just a free roaming place and no one would pay. So he would hide out in there. And that's usually how he would get to and from the Bowen house. He was either biking or sort of hanging around for several days and doing his stalking stints in between, you know?
How did he get in there? How long did he stay there? Like, what were you able to confirm is fact?
He was, from my maths and from what Tina tells me, he was living in the house between March 86 and December 86. So that's around 8-9 months. Right. How often he was there is up for debate. Like, you don't know. He wasn't there every day. And there were weeks at a time when he wouldn't be there. Like, if usually in school holidays for some reason. You think it'd be the other way around. You think he'd be there during the school holidays, but during the school holidays, he wasn't. The girls said there were less and less noises in the house. And he took an extended break during the summer for some reason. During the summer holidays, he wasn't there much at all. But it was around 8 or 9 months of, that's right, isn't it, March? Yeah, about 8, 9 months. And he was in and out regularly during that time. How he was getting in is, this annoyed me. This was actually what first drew me to the case, because when someone says you're hiding in the walls, that asks more questions than it answers, you know. So I was like, right, there's any journalist with integrity would say, hang on, how exactly does that happen? Because that's not, you know, that doesn't say a whole lot. So that's what drew me into it. And then the next question was, how does someone get into your house without you knowing? Now, here in the UK, we have, our houses are quite tight. Like, even the big houses are quite tight, you know. So if I hear someone at my next door neighbor's door, I can hear them, you know. So I can hear people in the street a mile off. But so I don't know if there's a British or an American like cultural difference, but how is someone getting your house without you hearing, you know? Surely you'd hear something somewhere. Mm-hmm. But the anticlimactic answer, unfortunately, is that Dan just walked in. There were two doors into the Bowen house, and he took one when no one was around. And of course, it was Lauren Street. The houses are spaced out evenly. People aren't going to see someone coming and going, and they didn't lock the doors. So the unfortunate answer is he just walked in. Now, if this was a horror movie, that explanation wouldn't fly, but the reality is that it's a pretty disappointing answer. But that's what he did. Yeah, he was just coming in. He most went in through the front door, and because they had a split-level home, the bedrooms were upstairs, and their living room and basement were downstairs. Coming through the front door, go downstairs, into the basement, into his hiding space, and then he'd stay there. And he knew the schedules of the girls. He knew Frank, the father. He was rarely there anyway because he worked so hard, because he's a single parent, and he owned a hotel nearby. So he was never there. So he was, you know, the adult in the house wasn't aware of this intrusion. And Dan was just smart enough to know how to play the game, really. So he was smart enough to know how to be Shadow. And he was.
How much of the story that has been reported, I know it's probably a minuscule percent at this point, how much of the interference, this mysterious interference, was the family experiencing? I know there's the story about how the girls tried to, for fun, contact their deceased mother, and then noises started to happen and they started to get freaked out, and there were subsequently messages being left around the house. How much of that is filler for the media story versus what actually happened? And of course, I know, Joe, that there's a book coming, and there's a lot of things that you're going to tell us in this book that we want to read when it comes out. But how much of this, what of that is bullshit?
Weirdly, now this is the part you would think was 50% bullshit, but it's not. There's, of all the stories that I've heard about this, only two of them were nonsense. So the vast majority of the details are all true. And the girls themselves will tell you this. And weirdly, what is reported is nowhere near the level of what actually happened. It was going on for 9 months continuously, to the point that, I don't know if you know Kathy, the older girl, the adopted girl, the adopted sister, because there were two Bowen sisters, the biological ones, and they had an adopted
you
sister.
You confirmed that there was the friends / adopted sister who was a year older than Tina.
That was Kathy Knapp. Yeah, she was. She met Tina at school, and then Frank adopted her because her parents moved back to Tennessee, and she didn't want to go with them, so she stayed in Townsend with the Bowens, and she lived there with them. Now she got so freaked out by these constant interruptions that she was on the verge of going to therapy because she thought she was going mad. So that's how bad it got. Now that kind of stuff has not been reported before. But it really was exactly like the stories say. There were constant noise in the house, constant things going missing. They had to start putting lines on alcohol bottles because they'd wake up in the morning and they'd be a little bit lower. There would be music coming from outside, which this stalker would engineer to be created. The seance incident, that was real. It was a freakishly bizarre coincidence, because the girls did indeed try and have a seance to contact their dead mother, because all these noises, they were convinced, you know, they were the naive brains of teenagers and a 9-year-old, they're going to think maybe our mom was trying to contact us. So they did perform a seance, and at the same time Dan was in his hiding place causing trouble. Dan didn't know they were upstairs because he couldn't, you know, he was stationary in his hiding place, so he didn't know what the girls were doing upstairs. So it was just kind of a very freakishly bizarre time. You know, that is a kind of horror movie thing, because he was banging on the walls while they were having a seance. The odds of that are quite slim, but it did happen. And that's where it kind of, where it came from. And then to make it even more unreal. Now, I didn't believe this when Kathy told me, but apparently it did happen. And maybe she's misremembering, but it's pure horror story. After the seance, she came downstairs to the kitchen, and she saw a figure sitting at her kitchen table. And of course, she's 16. And she, I don't know how true this is, but she says a lightning bolt came outside and illuminated this figure sitting at the table. I thought, okay, I'm not sure that happened, but yeah. So this figure at the kitchen table, and there was someone there, and she was convinced it was the spirit of Ruth, their mother. Oh. And then she ran back upstairs to tell the girls. They believed her. They all ran down, but then the figure disappeared. So now I firmly believe that she saw someone sitting at their table, because Dan did used to sit at their table and purposely leave wrappers and crumbs out and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I believe that happened. The lightning bolt is probably a little bit flair, but yeah. So I believe that did happen, but that's kind of the extent of what happened. And then
that's incredible.
It wasn't until, and then this stuff kind of went on, this kind of innocuous, you know, banging and troublemaking and kind of signs someone else was in this house. And of course, Frank didn't believe them, didn't believe his daughters. Frank thought that they were going through hardship because their mother had only died the year before. So they thought it was just stress and trauma and stuff.
Yeah.
Then it wasn't until December 86 when they finally saw, Frank finally saw evidence that there was someone else living in that house. Now, I'm sure you know that part of the story because it's been mentioned a few times in places. So I'm sure you know that part. But that's when Dan kind of really upped his game.
That's when he materialized. That's when he was leaving more real evident indications that he was there.
Yeah, that's when he left messages on the walls. That's when he left a bathtub full of piss. He left a trail of pennies from the stairs down to the basement. He left a BB gun on the side. He got the Ruth's wedding dress out of the cupboard and laid it on the bed for some reason, which is where the myth that he was dressed in a wedding dress came from. And he put a knife through Tina's face on the wall, a picture of Tina's face. And he left a message in shaving foam that said, I'm going to kill you. That's when he kind of went from being a nuisance to a genuine threat, you know?
What do you think changed about him being a nuisance to really becoming, it became really sinister?
Yeah, I think we glossed over the fact that Tina and Dan had had a very brief relationship. They'd been on a couple of dates. Again, this was in Easter 86, so this was 8 months.
Well, before. I read in some of my research, I read in the Lowell Sun where Mr. Bowen had said he drove them to the movies and then he had Easter dinner with them.
Yeah.
That's the first time I had ever read any of that.
Yeah, they went on a one date in March 86. Then they went to have Easter dinner at Tina's nan's house. No, she's like Tina's aunt's house. Mm-hmm. And that was the last time her and Dan ever saw each other. And after that point, Tina was like, I've led him on long enough. Because Tina kind of felt sorry for him, you know? She was, like, she was boy obsessed in a nice way. And Dan was kind of like, she led him on a little bit. She entertained him and then she humoured him. And then she let him go. Now, I don't think Dan took that very well, because he'd never really had any female attention before. He's like a 16-year-old boy, you know, he's going to be fueled full of testosterone. Now, before this, I don't know if I mentioned this, but Dan already had a rape charge on his name. He'd already raped multiple women in town, and there was one woman.
I read of at least one, there was information that at least one was confirmed as, you know, a 14-year-old unnamed girl.
Yeah.
That we actually chatted about a bit. And I also read at some point he was acquitted of that charge.
He was. When it was just before he got caught in the Bowen house, he was acquitted of rape because they didn't have enough evidence. And I've talked to this victim extensively. She's a good friend of mine there. And she talked me through the whole thing, and she said, what evidence could she possibly provide to prove that she was raped? But she's like, Dan raped her in his friend's house. Like he had a specific rape room in his friend's attic that he used to take girls to. And only a couple of girls said that they'd been there, but only this one particular girl, you know, was brave enough to kind of divulge the whole details. But she said there were not enough evidence that the police could see, even though they saw the room where it happened the same day it happened, but they still didn't have enough. But that's a different story. It might probably be a different story now if it happened today, but back in 86, it was probably, you know, not as, what's the word, cared about, I guess. So he was acquitted of that rape charge in late 86. But yet, until then, he'd never really had any female attention. You know? Meanwhile, his friends, they did have girlfriends and stuff. So Dan might have felt a little bit, you know, why them? Why not me? Of whole incel mindset, yeah.
And he was, by this point, he's deeply disturbed based on his family life and experiences.
Yeah. I mean, he was a true psycho, you know? I mean, he was born with, antisocial personality disorder anyway. And then he had a horrible upbringing with his real father, who was not very kind to him at all. Meanwhile, his mother was kind of the opposite. She doted on him and believed the son shone out of his ass, you know. So Dan had these kind of two extremes in his life. Then his stepfather came along, and his stepfather was kind of indifferent. He was a nice guy, and he provided for the children, but he was just kind of like he didn't really care that much. But by that point, Dan was like 7, so the damage was already done. And then he grew up with this kind of, like, he needed to have armor, and his armor was kind of, if he bullies kids first, they can't bully him, you know. So he kind of did things that way. And he'd get into fights at school. He was cruel to animals. He would used to abduct rats and mice from his garden and torture them and stuff. He had a shed full of stray cats that he abducted in the back of his garden. Just kind of weird little things like that. And he had an obsession with the Nazis as well. That's something that's
not mentioned anyway. I think I touched on that a little bit with one of our exchanges, that there's no possible way I was ever in the same place as him. It just doesn't line up.
Yeah.
But I know people. I have friends who lived in that area who I was friends with, and I would, as a kid, we would get rides back and forth to visit each other.
Yeah.
And one of them, or two of them, went to St. Bernard's. We call it St. Bernard's because we have the Boston accent. And one of my friends relayed information about him being very strange, being a loner. Kind of preferring to be by himself, really.
Yeah, that's pretty much.
They said he was in. He was definitely into Nazis. He's like, he was into Nazi stuff and weird shit. And then there was this book they all had. He's like, yeah, Dan was into this book, The Vigilante's Handbook, or something like that.
Vigilante Handbook. Yeah, I know that one. I've heard that one. Yeah, absolutely.
They all had it, I guess, at that age when they were, you know, Dan was old. Dan's older than us for sure, but. It's the community of people, because it's small town stuff. All the kids hung around. There were younger kids, older, you know, there were like adults.
Yeah.
That would, I mean, to when you're my age, like adult was like, you know, a 19-year-old, right?
Yeah.
So we're hanging around at parties,
kids,
you know?
There's
just no way. It's a horrifying thought, though, to think, hearing all of these things about this boy and then what he has done to other people and now subsequently a murderer. So let's go to December 1986. Daniel LaPlante is discovered in the Bowen home. They have got to be horrified. He's arrested, and the Bowens temporarily leave their house on Lawrence Street in Pepperell, go someplace else to feel safer. What happens to Dan LaPlante when he is arrested by the Pepperell police?
He's taken to the police station, and Tom, the guy that arrested him, said he took 10 mugshots of Dan because he knew he'd be seeing him again. So he knew he'd need to spread them around town. And then Dan was sent to juvenile detention for what was meant to be a long time. In October 87, 10 months later, his mom bailed him out. So he spent 10 months in juvenile after that incident. He went through a few psychological evaluations at the time. And that was really all he did. He just spent his time in juvenile detention. Couldn't really do much else.
At that point when he was released, his mom took out a $10,000 mortgage on their home.
Mm-hmm.
He's released to her custody, I would imagine. He's 17 years of age by this time.
Yep.
And he's scheduled to appear in court in like December 11th or something like that of 1987. We know what happens on December 1st of 1987, however. So he never made it to court to face, I guess at this point, an adult charge for the kidnapping, etc., for the Bowen incident?
No, he never got there. Those crimes weren't able to be used in the Gustafson trial either.
Right.
So his criminal past was not taken into consideration. Not that it mattered, because he got 3 life sentences anyway. He wasn't going to be charged as an adult for the stalking crimes. And I think it was only...
He wasn't.
It was a juvenile court, I believe. I've got the actual thing here that it tells me. But no, he wasn't. And it was only on breaking and entering. It wasn't on stalking, I believe.
That's something that was a little cloudy to me, because I know that he was in juvenile hall or juvenile detention. He turned 17 while he was there. He was bailed out by his mom. And then they set a date with air. The gray area for me was, okay, so did his juvenile charges then graduate to adult charges?
Yeah, he was meant to be charged as an adult for the breaking and entering and attempted aggravated assault. So stalking wasn't exactly in the question. But of course, I suppose it's hard to, you know, confirm that he had been in the house for so long, because all they had was the three girls' testimonies, and unfortunately testimonies aren't worth a lot. I mean, obviously he was in the house. They probably couldn't prove it, so they just got him on breaking and entering and aggravated assault. But of course he never came around to that. Something overrode it. Danny's psychiatrist believed that Danny's motivation was love and affection. There you go. That's a scoop.
Because he just upped his game. Yeah. So he's released in October. Within about a week's time, Daniel LaPlante is back to his old ways and breaking into homes. But one thing that differentiated Daniel LaPlante from just your average everyday burglar thief is he was getting off on disturbing the residents. He was breaking into homes. Sometimes, don't we know, small towns just leave the door unlocked, unfortunately. That's something I tell everybody all the time. Lock your fucking doors. He was sometimes breaking into homes or sometimes just walking through unlocked doors, moving things around, playing on the emotions of the people whose homes that he was in, sometimes taking things, but sometimes leaving things.
Yeah.
So this behavior ramped up right after he got out of the juvenile detention.
Burglary was his main motivation because he liked stealing things, basically. And he'd always done that from when he was like 14. He was breaking into houses and shops in Townsend, stealing stuff all the time. So that was kind of second nature to him. But yeah, when he was out of juvenile, he did, if there was nothing he could find that that was worth taking, he'd just move something around or just to let the owners know that he'd been there. And I think he got the idea from Charles Manson, because at this point, Charles Manson was a notable figure. And Dan did have one particular friend that was very serial killer obsessed, got Dan into Nazis and serial killers. And the two serial killers in particular were Charles Manson and Ian Brady, if you know them, Ian Brady, obviously, was also a child murderer. So that could have, imprinted on Dan as well. Got the idea from Charles Manson, because Charles Manson used to get his followers to go in people's houses and walk around, not take anything, just to get used to the idea of being around sleeping people and being, stealthy and shadow-like. So I think that's where Dan got the idea from. And of course, it gave him a thrill as well, knowing the idea that someone would wake up and be terrified. That's what got him off. And obviously, that's what got him off before with Tina as well, because he spent 8 months doing exactly that to her. So that became kind of a thing for him, Over time, that wasn't enough. He had to get closer to the terror, I think at first he liked to be distant from the terror, because he liked to start fires as well. And that's kind of the same crime. You start a fire, you can step back. You don't have to be there when the fire takes hold, You're completely gone. Right. So it's like terror from a distance. And I think Dan kind of got off on that for a while. And then over time, that's not enough. You need to kind of up the ante, progress stuff, be closer to it, keep chasing that high that you got the first time. And to do that, you have to take more risks. And that's when he decided to go full homicide.
Because he had broken into the Gustafson home in early November and taken a number of things. How often did you sort out that he was actually at the Gustafson home?
He was there a lot because it was the closest house to his house, because all he had to do was go in his back garden, and he played in those woods from when he was in his early teens. So he knew that house very well. He knew the whole layout. And another thing was, Judith Viewegg, her house was next to the Gustafson's house.
100 or 200 yards away, yeah?
Yeah, and Dan was drawn to that house because of its morbid history. So obviously he knew that whole area super well. And I think he was at the Gustafson's house a lot. People in town said, we used to see him hanging outside the stretch of woodland daily, really. He obviously got in the house at least once before, but chances are it's a lot more because he knew his way around the house, basically. You don't get that off one visit. He knew it well. So chances are he burgled that house several times at least.
And he went back on December 1st, 1987. Yeah. It's been suggested that he was going to rob it again, but do you think he had that plan all along, or as some writing has suggested, that he just decided in the moment what he was going to do when Priscilla and little William came in?
No, I think he had every intention to kill Priscilla, because he came with a gun and a bunch of bullets, and he had a porno magazine with him as well. And I don't think you go anywhere without a gun, a loaded gun and a porno mag, without the intention of doing something pretty horrific. So I think he had every intention to kill Priscilla, because I don't see what he would get from killing a child. And I think he only killed William and Abigail because they happened to be collateral. They were there. But I think he had these urges he's always had the urge to rape. He's always been a rapist from when he was 15. So that was probably his guiding principle. Of course, he needed to up the stakes to get that high again. And he'd been in juvenile for 10 months, so he'd been festering with these feelings, for a long time.
He was making a lot of plans. When I get out, you and I are when I'm done with this project, I'm going to, I don't know, take a long weekend. He's like, when I'm out of here, I'm going to up my crime game.
Yeah, exactly. It became an obsession more than just something that you wanted to do, It became a compulsion. I firmly believe that he fully intended to rape her and kill her as well. So yeah, I think he did. And then when he saw her come in the house with William, he knew he had to kill William as well. And he killed William first.
He did. It was unclear.
He killed William first. He bound Priscilla up on the bed. He tied her up with stockings, pantyhose. And then he drowned William in the bathtub. He held him at gunpoint first, tied her up, drowned William. So Priscilla was alive while son was drowned in the bathtub. And as someone with a young boy, it's a horrible thing to talk about. And then he came back, he raped her, and then he put his pistol inside a pillowcase, probably to silence it. But Dan always did little weird things like that that made no sense. And then he shot Priscilla in the head. And then he just left her. Although he did do some weird things around the house before he left, he opened a condom and left it on the side, and left it on the floor, even though he didn't use it. So I don't know what that's about.
What do you make of the condoms that they said were cut? The end was cut.
I got pictures of those condoms right in front of me, the exact ones from the crime scene. I don't know why he would do that. He would leave things behind for no reason. When he was on the run, he left his jacket behind for some reason, and no one has ever been able to figure out why. And he would just leave little things around, like he left wine glasses at the Gustafson house as well, and he moved things around on the table. And for someone who was trying to hide his tracks, it's the antithesis of that. So I don't understand why he would do that. I don't understand why he would cut these condoms. It's just he had some weird compulsion to mess with things. Unless he was kind of a metaphor or symbolism, but I don't think Dan's that smart. So I don't know. This is the honest answer.
It was pretty clear to authorities that he was, if not the first person to look at.
Yeah, straight away. Dan was number one. There was one other suspect below him. They found him immediately and they completely confirmed his alibi. So the only other option was Dan. He was the same officers that found him in the Bowen house that said, you know what, this has got Dan LaPlante written all over it. Plus his house was like visible from the crime scene. So like, probably him.
And then the dog walked right through straight line from the Gustafson's home to 22 West Elm Street to the front door. And of course they had to question the brother and the brother's friend at first to rule them out. But it was so very obvious based on everything the town had known about this boy from his adolescent years. You know, there's even one report he was a suspect in the robbery of a store when he was about 12.
He did do that robbery. He did. The brick store robbery. He did do it. One of Dan's friends who used to rob with him told me, he says, yeah, it was us.
Have you spoken to Daniel LaPlante?
No, I've never spoken directly to Dan. I've spoken
Have you tried?
A bunch of times. We've all tried. We tried to get Netflix to speak to him, but he wouldn't speak to them either. I've spoken to him through two other people. Someone else at his prison. I spoke to the cellmate and then to Dan, and they passed messages through. And I spoke to Dan through his mom as well. So I called his mom a few times, and she passed messages on to him, because she sees him every week in prison still.
She does not think that he in any way is responsible for this?
No, she's maintained innocence from day one. Whether it's just, you know, her being a mom, I don't know. Whether she actually believes it is another story. I think there's a part of her that thinks, yeah, he's... But she also told me she's never, ever spoken to Dan about the case in 37 years or whatever it is. She sees him every week and she's never spoken about it to him. So I don't know. I think she's got in a bit of denial there. She's a river in Egypt. She's in denial.
Good Lord. What's the status of his siblings? I know he has two brothers. Did you say that he had a sister too?
He's got two brothers, one older, one younger, Stephen and Matt, and one older sister, Angela.
And she was really not privy to any of these things he did with the Bowen household, correct?
No. Did I tell you that?
You did.
Talked to his sister once, and she knows all about his murders, obviously. And I asked her, what do you think about the whole stalking and the wall stuff? She said, what the hell are you talking about? I don't know. I said, how do you not know?
Right.
Knowledge for 30 years. and your own brother. And she just didn't know. So I was the one that had to tell her about this stuff, which is a very bizarre conversation. But yeah, but she did visit Dan a bunch of times because she lived in Colorado for a while. Dan was in prison in Colorado. We got transferred there. So she used to visit him regularly there. But again, she said she never talked about the case to him either. So maybe it's just a... I mean, I've never had a relative commit murder, so I don't know if you're supposed to talk to them about it or something, but his mom and sister didn't want to talk about it. His brothers are fine. I mean, his older brothers are really well. He's got his own business, got his own family, and he still lives in Townsend, I believe. Younger brothers moved away and changed his name. Didn't want the LaPlante name on him. Didn't want the plague, so... They're all fine, really. The rest of his family are absolutely fine. So,
how are the Bowen ladies these days? I know you said that Frank Bowen passed away at a pretty young age.
Frank was passed away in 99, so he would have been 40-something. He was in his 30s and 80s. So he was barely 50 when Frank passed away. Passed in 99. What's weird is that the other victims in the story, there are two victims. There's girls that Dan assaulted. There's Shannon, the main one, and a couple of others that Dan didn't fully rape, but he kind of, you know, tried to rape them, and that's bad enough, you know, obviously.
Reports are that he was pretty inappropriate and didn't really know how to... He didn't have any chick chops. He didn't know how to behave around ladies.
No game. Yeah, you gotta be
smooth. No riz. Girls.
No riz, I heard that. My kids say that. And there was also Pamela... Pamela Mackler was her name at the time. She was the one that Dan drove her car while he was on the run. He abducted
That's
her.
That's right.
Yeah, Pamela.
And that weird, bright orange VW bug that was just so inconspicuous.
Yeah. Told you he was kind of an idiot. You pick
He's a
black
moron.
Sedan, don't you, if you're going to go on the run. Yeah. You don't pick an orange van. Pamela and Shannon, they're doing fantastic in life. They're completely they've come to terms with everything and stuff. Pamela lives in Florida now. She lives right on the beach. So she's awesome. Same for Shannon as well. She's doing great. It's really just the Bowen family that kind of remain hurt by this.
Are any of the Bowen people still in the Massachusetts area, or has everyone left? I know there was the older sister, Darlene, too. Considerably older.
Yeah, Darlene was from Frank's first marriage. So she was about 10 years older. Darlene still lives nearby. Karen lives nearby. Tina and Kathy are both, they've moved away, yeah. But the rest of the Bowen clan, they all still live nearby. So it's only really Tina and Kathy that have gone to different states.
They've been open with you throughout the years.
The first girl I contacted was Kathy, because Kathy was the most approachable one. Right, I found her first. I talked to her. And she was the one that put me in contact with Tina. And at that point, Tina had never spoken to anyone about this. This must have been 2020. This is like 4 years ago. And I remember I called Tina. I was on the phone. I was thinking, shit, what the hell do I ask her? She's never spoken about this to anyone in 33 years by this point. And me and her were on the phone for 3 hours talking. And she told me absolutely everything from start to finish. She was the nicest person I've ever spoken to. She was fantastic. Karen was great with me the first time I talked to her. Me and her got on really well. I've interviewed for my book, at least 100 people. I expected a lot more people to tell me to get lost, but no one did, really. And one guy that was went to school with Dan, they all said, no, I don't want to talk about it. But there's been like 100 other people that said, yeah, I can't wait to talk about this stuff. I've been waiting for years to talk about it. Which, again, I thought was quite strange, but great news for me. So I welcomed it.
Yeah. I know the book is complete, yeah?
Yes, it has been completed.
You're waiting to be able to release that. I know you probably have a plan in place with how you want to release that. I know you have some other projects in the works. Is there anything that you are at liberty to share? You wrote something on your website about the Kim Cates Mont Vernon story.
The Disciples. Yes, the Disciples. You know the case, the Mont Vernon one.
I went to high school in the next town over, which borders Mont Vernon and Amherst.
Heard of it. Yeah, we were looking into that one because there's a ton of stuff that's never been reported. Like the Disciples were a much bigger cult than they realized. Like Stephen Spader was a real he knew what he was doing. He was a real functional psychopath. He could really manipulate these followers.
I would love for this stuff to be able to be released because there's so much misinformation. And like you even said on your web page, people are reporting misinformation. They continue to report misinformation. I listened to a pretty reputable podcast and their episode about the LaPlante story. It was all wrong. I have come to learn through my own research that everything that was there was down to the wrong names. We know that they were called the Andersons or something, or Andrews.
Andrews, Jessica and Annie, yeah.
Well, where did that come from? That was just a made-up thing? Like, what?
It came from the Investigation Discovery show that covered it in about 2014, I think. They just made up some names, basically. Oh my God. I love it when the explanation is so simple that it's just like they just made it up.
This is what I hate about this genre is that people just make up stories. They develop their own dumb theories about things. Yeah. And then, you know, they make up stories about family members, how family members have some responsibility. It's sickening to me.
It's awful.
This case in particular, it's hard to get factual information. You really have to dig. I dug really deep just to find the information about the mom. Like, I found the death notice for the mom.
Yeah, you did.
That took forever.
You found a picture of Pam's orange van.
Yes.
I've never seen that picture, and I've seen every picture.
There's a black and white picture of it that's out, and there's like cops. You know, it's from the scene. Cops are around it. Yeah, I mean, if you want me to email you all of that stuff, if you don't have it, a hard copy of it, I can send you all of that stuff.
Wow.
If there's anything that you've seen that you don't have that you saw that I have, I'll drop it in an email. I'm happy to share all of that stuff.
I've got all the crime scenes.
You must have filed FOIAs for all that stuff, and they gave it to you.
They did.
They gave it to you willingly?
No, I had to fight really, really hard.
I'm of the belief, and it sounds like you probably share this sentiment, that he would have gone on to kill, and he would have been on the level of somebody like Bundy, BTK, perhaps.
He would have probably got
Ridgeway.
Yeah. If he was smart enough to not get caught, yes. Then he could have, maybe not Ridgeway or Bundy, because they were like 30 to 50, I guess, but he could at least have gotten, I don't know, five or six, like Ramirez levels. But he wasn't smart enough to kind of outwit the police. He thought he was, but he only thought he was because he never really dealt with any repercussions before. Like, he'd just done what he wanted his entire life and never really got any, never even been admonished for it. So he thought he was invincible. And of course, the consequence of his actions caught up with him. And he was imprisoned after his first serious crime. If he was a little bit more aware, and maybe if he was a bit older, because of course he was 17, so his brain wasn't fully matured at that point. If he was a little bit older, maybe if he was like 25, he could have been a lot more dangerous.
He was on the way. At that period, this is something that maybe you can confirm for me. What was his schooling like at that point? I know he had gone to the Catholic school for a year. Then he left the Catholic school, went back to public school in Townsend. But when he met Tina Bowen, who went to Townsend, the Townsend Regional Public School, despite the fact she was from Pepperell, they weren't schoolmates. It would have been really obvious to her if he attended school with her when he said, "I got your number through a friend from school."
No,
that was unclear to me.
Tina and Dan didn't go to the same school. They went to different schools.
Was he even in school at that time? Or was he a dropout? Yeah, like, I don't even know.
He was in school. He went to a bunch of different schools. I'm just trying to remember the timeline. Because there was St. Bernard's, mm-hmm. North Regional Middlesex, and Hawthorne mm-hmm. Brook. They were the three that Dan went to. Meanwhile, Tina went to... I can't remember the name of their school, but theirs was in Pepperell, because that had been Pepperell. But no, they didn't go to the same school. But the way they met was that Tina was Tina used to give her number out to local boys because that's just what she did. You know, that's how you met people back in 1986, you know. So she used to just give her phone number to people. And of course, it was a landline number because you didn't have cell phones back then, I believe. And Dan got her number from another boy that she passed it to. And that's when he started calling her and telling her who he was. And of course, Tina had never seen Dan in the flesh at that point.
So that is true. He did get it from a friend because there was a theory that he had broken into their house at one period of time and saw her photograph and was into her.
He most likely did not. However, what's weird is the way they first met was Tina was at an event at her school. Right? And then this boy tapped her on the shoulder. She turned around and it was this disheveled guy with greasy black hair and a black leather jacket. She said, "Hi, I'm Dan. I'm the one you've been speaking to on the phone for the past few months." She doesn't know how Dan knew what she looked like.
Oh.
They'd never seen each other. So that remains a mystery. Now, I think it's simple as Dan said to one of his friends, "Which one's Tina?" And they said, that's Tina. Or it's possible he was already kind of scoping her out at this point from afar. That's how they met initially. That's when they got together, started going on dates. And of course, Tina said, "He's nothing like what he described on the phone. It's time to end it." So that's how they first met. Not a love story at all, unfortunately.
No, it's very teen.
Yeah, it's not Julia Roberts. Weirdly, Dan, he was really strong. He was muscly. He was a football player. So he had kind of the body, you know? He had kind of the metabolism and stuff. He just had a horrible acne-ridden face.
Because he was filthy. He didn't wash.
No, he was crap. No, he was rubbish. He used to wear the same clothes every day, take them off, be all sweaty, put them back on the next day.
This is just so interesting to me to connect these dots because I am like, I've been reading about this case for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and you know, suspending my disbelief about some of the things that I've read and wanting to put some real answers to some of this. And you've been really helpful in doing that. Yeah. And I'm going to...
I don't understand.
Yeah, I bet.
So I'm just trying to think of some of the questions that I don't know the answer to.
Here are a couple of things maybe you can clear up for me. His natural biological father, whom I assume is a LaPlante, in fact sexually abuse him?
His real dad was... Oh, it's a weird story. Dan was the product of an affair from his mom.
Oh.
So his real dad wasn't his real dad. Elaine was his mom, and Claude was Elaine's husband. Now, Claude was the one that gave birth to Dan's older sister. So, that impregnated his mom and made their older sister and older brother. Then Elaine had an affair with one of Claude's workmates. And this is the really, really funny part. The guy's name was Willie Moore. Does that mean anything to you? Yeah, she had an affair with a man named Willie Moore. Now, over here, Willie means your cock, and Moore... So she had an affair with a guy with a perfect name to have an affair with. And then she got pregnant with Dan. Now,
but then she married a Moore later.
That's where it gets really weird. So it gets super weird. So Claude, the husband, found out about this deceit after Dan was born because Dan looked nothing like the others because Dan had he's obvious to see. Plus Dan behaved a lot differently to his brother and his sister. So Claude's like, "What the hell's going on?" So, and then Elaine confessed that she had an affair, and Claude is like, "Oh, okay, so it's not my baby." Claude took his frustrations out on Dan, which is where the brunt of the problems began. Now, he didn't sexually assault him as such, but he was very abusive to him. And now you can verify this because Claude LaPlante was also a criminal in the area. He was a rapist. He was on a rape charge when Dan was 2 years old. Not against Dan, against the local woman. So he was also a deviant. And again, he was a suspect in some of the 70s murders. Weirdly, Elaine and Claude had another baby, and that was Matt. But still, the signs of deceit, Claude couldn't get over the fact that his third child wasn't biologically his. it caused a rift in the relationship, and they broke up. And then Claude disappeared in like 78, I think, and then they never saw him again. And he died a few years ago. Now, this is where it gets odd, because Elaine was now a single mom of four. So Dan's biological dad, William Moore, set Elaine up with his brother. His brother named David. So Elaine then got together with the brother of Dan's biological father. So basically Dan's...
So his stepdad was his uncle.
Stepdad was his uncle, yeah. Weird. Dan didn't find this out until court. Because when he was in court, it all had to be brought up because of the legal familial relations and stuff.
He never knew that his biological father was somebody else.
No, he thought it was Claude from the beginning. And then he found out in court that that wasn't the case. Because I think it was because David Moore had to announce his relationship to the family. And yeah, that's how it all came out. Dan's sister and Dan's cousin both told me exactly the same story. So of course that's going to mess Dan up. But by this point, Dan had already, you know, killed three people, including two children. So he was already beyond help.
I mean, emotionally, he was disturbed. You know, some people will tell you that no one's born bad. Other people will say that, you know, some people, it's just there and it's brought out by abuses, traumas.
Dan was born bad, according to the psychiatrist that evaluated it. Said he was born, he said no amount of mental rehabilitation could help him. He was always going to be a child onset type B from day one. Mm-hmm. Apparently he was born to be bad. But then you throw in parental abuse from day one, and you got the perfect cocktail for a bastard.
So then there was sexual abuse in the mix by not a parental figure then, but by a doctor?
Oh, so no, Dan was never sexually abused from what I know. I've never been able to corroborate from anyone. No, I mean, I've heard that story going around a lot, and I've never been able to find anyone who knew this psychiatrist or this doctor or anyone that abused him. If it was true, someone would know about it. Someone from the school would know about it, but no one ever does. No one's ever.
And it was never documented in any of the court records or court examinations that he was subjected to. None of that ever came out. So all of that information that has been reported about Daniel LaPlante's past is untrue.
Probably nonsense. He went to a weird special school for a few months called a day school. Apparently it was a thing in the 80s. And that was kind of known for being very strict and being a bit on the religious side. And I hate to, generalize, but you've all heard the stories about Catholic schools and children.
Oh, it's real.
You know, there's a chance it happened there, but no one has ever been able to corroborate it. Although one of the teachers did refuse to talk to me about it. So I don't know what that says.
And he did spend time at that Catholic school in Fitchburg. St. Bernard's is for a long time was funded by, I believe, the Worcester Diocese, and is not any longer, but had been.
See, there's a seed there, but I couldn't confirm it, unfortunately. So I had to leave it out because I didn't want to put any rumors in either.
Well, and you know, that's something I want to clear up, because I don't want to put that out there. I've reported that, you know, when I talk about something, it's been widely reported that Daniel LaPlante was sexually abused by a parental figure and a doctor. Well, if that's not actually the case, he's just messed up from jump. That's a whole different story.
I mean, his real father was, well, I say his real father, but Claude was abusive to him. He was verbally abusive and probably physically abusive, but never sexually.
It's never come out in any of the documentation. Wow.
No record of it at all. You'd think he would be there because of what Dan became, but strange.
It makes you wonder about the mother. I have so many questions about the mother, and you've spoken to her at length. And she just says the same sorts of things about him, right? That he was a delightful darling.
Pretty much. She's always said that he believes he's innocent and that he was framed. She's part of the conspiracy crowd that think that, I'm not sure if you heard the weird theory that Andrew Gustafson hired Dan to kill his own family.
No.
Yeah, that's really that, Tina believes that as well. Tina Bowen believes that. She's a big advocate of that odd theory. She believes that Andrew Gustafson hired Dan. Weirdly, Dan and Andrew did have a connection, because when Dan was on trial for the stalking and the aggravated assault and the break and entering, Andrew Gustafson was meant to be his lawyer. However, there were only two lawyers in Townsend. So there was a 50%, it was a 50-50 chance. There was a coin flip that he was going to get Andrew Gustafson. Now, Dan then fired Andrew Gustafson from being his lawyer for some reason. Don't know why. And then a few months later, Dan kills his ex-lawyer's family.
Wow.
Don't know why. Some people think that Andrew hired Dan to kill them because he wanted rid of them. Don't see why Andrew Gustafson would do that. It seems like a very odd way to do things. And the reason that theory's got legs is because Andrew shacked up with his new wife 8 months after they died in the same house. So that's why people think it's a little bit weird. Who are we to put a stopwatch on how long you have to grieve for? I don't know. His mom believes that theory, that Andrew used him as a patsy, But if you think about it for more than like 10 seconds, it's obviously not true, because Dan was in court. He'd just go, well, Andrew paid me to kill him, so put him behind bars and not me, you know?
There's just too many other factors in what happened in that home and what led up to what the events of that night or day. Yeah.
The implication of that is that Dan loves Andrew Gustafson so much that he's willing to go to prison for the rest of his life for him, which I don't think is true at all.
He never said any of that when he was arrested after that, you know, chase through pepperil and air and all that. He never said any of that out of the gate.
Yeah. The first thing I'd say if the police were on me, I'd say, well, he paid me.
He paid me in cable box remote controls, because that's what every 17-year-old boy wants, right? I got some Liberty coins.
Well, tell you what's really weird. The other day, someone emailed me out of the blue saying that she was Dan's girlfriend for the past 30 years. And I said, what the fuck are you talking about? She said, me and Dan have been in a phone relationship since 1991. And I said, okay. The reason she emailed me is because Dan stopped responding to her calls a few years ago, and she wanted me to reconnect her with him. And she did say that in the early 90s, Dan gave her $20,000. I don't know how that's possible. So I'm just saying, I hate to be, you know, I hate to color these conspiracy theories in, but it's something to think about.
Well, I imagine he also probably has a fair amount of those murder groupies too, because those folks come out of the woodwork. And if you spend any time reading about people like Chris Watts and Scott Peterson, their canteens are full of dough because of all the ladies that think that they're completely innocent and hot behind bars. And that's a whole that's a whole personality disorder.
That's weird to me. Yeah, I don't understand those people.
It's all really fascinating. And you've added more fuel to the fire with the conspiracy stuff, which I totally get that that's a part of these cases. Just because of the nature of human beings and...
Yeah, absolutely. You always look for explanations, don't you? You always look for some kind of reason within it. The two people that believe it are Tina and Dan's mom. The only two people in the story that forgive him, you know? Kind of forgive him in some kind of visceral level. I think these conspiracies are just kind of a way for them to justify their own beliefs to themselves, maybe.
Do you think, given this information that you've been able to gather from the family and, you know, piecing things together from Daniel LaPlante's upbringing and life, you know, he's proven that he wanted to murder and did murder. Do you think that he would have gotten to that with the Bowen family if he hadn't been discovered when he was? Do you think that he seriously would have tried to hurt or murder one of those girls in that home?
Yes, I think Tina was his target by the end of this. And when they found him for the first time, he did have a wrench in his hand. Now, you don't go around with a wrench if you're not planning on using it to either fix your car or hit someone with it, you know? I think he did have the intention to hurt Tina. At this point, he was still a year younger, so whether he would have progressed to actual murder, I don't know. but I think he did have the intention to do some damage to her, you know.
And we knew that he was sexually dangerous.
Yeah, very much so. So I think he was planning on it at some point. And I think he was kind of building up to it. I think he was watching her from afar to kind of, I think because he liked her, you know, he fancied her, he wanted to be closer to her. And then that obsession turned into rage. And because he couldn't get her consensually, he was going to force it out of her, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what he
was. I think that's true. I think ultimately that's where it would have gone, because it had built up over those months.
Mm-hmm.
And we had figured out that his mind, it was a race against time, maybe, for his own mind and desires and proclivities, or however you want to describe those things. I don't understand what that mind is like, but we've seen it. History has shown us a lot of people who think this way. And then ultimately, after he went to juvenile detention and served those 10 or so months and came out, he had definitely had a lot of time to simmer with whatever his mind was saying or playing.
Absolutely. So it was over 10 months, and then he grew to critical mass and he couldn't contain it anymore. And Priscilla Gustafson and her children were the first people. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. He's in prison. He cannot go up for parole until he's about, 62 years of age? So we've got some time. We have until, what is it, 2032 or something like that?
9 years left, yes. He will petition to get the parole brought forward, which he's done twice already, but he's been rejected both times. So chances are he won't be up for parole until 2033. I don't think he will get parole, because he's been in prison his entire adult life. He can't adjust to the outside now. And if he did ever go back to Townsend, or if the people of Townsend knew that he was free, I think he'd be hanging from a tree before the day was out.
And Frank Bowen, if he were alive, I think he would be the first in line, because he even said it himself that he wanted to kill him if he was out again.
He paid one of the guards to flush Stan's head down the toilet on his first day of prison. Frank did.
Do any of the LaPlante Moore family members live in the area? Is the mom still around? You said the boys, some of the brothers are probably in the area. Is the mom around?
I forgot to mention, Elaine still lives in the exact same house that Dan grew up in, the same one.
Oh, Jesus.
She hasn't moved. So if you ever want to know where she lives, just pop by. I've thought about going myself.
I've mapped it all out. I know where everything is. I Googled everything. I did the whole, I know where everything is. I mean, I'm not that close, but it wouldn't take me long to get there, but.
I think I'm going to go there when I go to Townsend. I'm going to go knock on her door.
I would hope you would. I would hope you would go and see what she has to offer.
I'm going to go see Dan's old bedroom. I wonder if it's still the same as it was in 1986.
I wonder what she may have found in there if she was brave or curious enough to go in there and look after he was gone out.
I've got pictures of Dan's bedroom if you want to see them. They're not very pretty. They're just full of.
I mean, I bet the investigators turned it upside down. They must have.
They found two newspapers, and he had he was reading stories about himself in the newspapers.
Oh, that's inevitable, right? With these people, there's got to be a level of narcissism that comes into play too. I mean, even though he wasn't a bright person, he was diabolical enough.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. He was very, quite vain, narcissistic. They all are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's being treated for probably a series of things in prison. We know that he is antisocial.
Oh, yeah.
Probably has some level of mental illness.
He's definitely got some kind of antisocial personality disorder. I don't know exactly what he's being treated for, but I know that he's very isolated and he doesn't have many friends and he doesn't do a whole lot outside of talking to his mum. And he was studying law at one point. I'm not sure if he's still doing that. But I don't think he's not the most favourable criminal. He tries to keep himself on the down low, I think, because I think he still gets beaten up by the other inmates because he's a child murderer, basically. So he's bottom mm-hmm. of the totem pole. Mm-hmm. And that's what, there was a period in the 90s where he was transferred to California because he was scared of being killed by the other inmates. Mm. So they transferred him all the way to California where no one knew who he was. Then they brought him back in the early 2000s. But yeah, so he tries to stay anonymous. Hmm. There you go.
But he did try to sue a number of times, right? Because he felt like his rights were being violated. He couldn't get to the law library enough, and he couldn't get, you know, feathers and, you know, pigeon blood for his quote-unquote Wiccan ceremonies.
Yeah. I think he's just bored, and he's just trying to cause trouble for the courts.
I think you're right.
Because they keep denying his parole, pulling them forward, he's just trying to cause as much problems as he can, as much hassle. Because they have to kind of do something about it, you know? There's a religious complaint. They have to do things. I'm like, oh, for God's sake. So he just likes to wind them up. Yeah. He's still the same little shit that he was 35 years ago, you know? So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that definitely probably has been reinforced over these last, you know, decades.
Yeah. Oh, well. It's ironic that he will spend the rest of his life in a small space because that's what got him in trouble in the first place.
That's right. That's right. It was a very small space that he could. What were the measurements that the investigator said he could at his side, at the investigator's size and weight, he could probably squeeze into like an 8.5-inch opening. And Daniel LaPlante was so much thinner that he could have squeezed through like a 7.5-inch opening. And that's pretty much what got him inside this little weird corner.
Little fridge. It was a 7-inch gap between, pulled the wood away. And yeah, it was a gap of 7 inches that Tom said that he would slip into, which is insane.
And he just found this at random. Like, there was no way for him to truly know that this space existed. He just happened upon it.
I mean, it's possible that Tina had brought Dan home at some point before and they'd been around the house and he'd seen it then. She says not, but it was 35 years ago. You can't remember everything, every little detail, you know. Yeah. So there's a chance it was that, or there's a chance he just snuck in the house when they were at school and he was, you know, truanting, and he just wandered around the house freely and was able to find it like that. But a lot of Dan's friends said he was really good at hiding, whether that's played a part or not. And weirdly, Dan used to make tunnels from his own bedroom to the rest of the parts of his house. So he was really good at getting into small spaces. So it was like a thing for him. It was like a fetish. He had a whole
fetish. I hope that he's enjoying his very small cell in MCI Norfolk or wherever he is now.
Yeah, MCI Norfolk. Let's hope he never gets out.
State of Massachusetts, despite the court's ruling about adolescence, he is not one of those perpetrators that they're going to take any compassion on. He is not one of them.
He's too notorious. Crimes were too serious as well. I remember I tried to get the court, the transcripts from his court a few years ago. The phone operator said, I said, it's for Daniel LaPlante. And oh, God, not that guy. We don't talk about him around here. He's too notorious. And the district attorney at the time, Tom Royley, he's retired now, but he still has some political sway in the courts in Massachusetts. He was the main guy that got Dan the life sentence despite him being 17. And if he's still around when Dan's parole comes up, there's no chance Tom won't come out of retirement and say, no, you keep that son of a bitch in prison till the day he dies. So that's always useful to have. Yeah.
Oh, Tom Riley has been quoted as saying that he's somebody that would have ramped up the violence and he would have ramped up the death.
Yeah. Tom was great. Tom was very instrumental in getting justice, really. There was this weird documentary made about Dan in 1989 about all his crimes. It was like this 3-hour-long documentary that was made by this Channel 5 team. And Tom got the documentary scrubbed from the earth because it blamed porn and heavy metal on Dan doing why Dan knew what he did. And Tom thought it was stupid, so he got the whole thing scrunched.
Well, that was a very 80s. That was a very 80s kind of thing. The influence of, you probably saw it, you know, being in the UK, you probably at least heard
Judas Priest
later. How Judas Priest and Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath were being held responsible by all of the misspent youth or all of the things that happened to teenage kids. For some people, that influences behavior. A small amount of people who are already, they're already miswired. And that bad video games, you know, don't force people to, don't drive people to kill. But if you're already, you know, your wiring is already crossed, then that's a whole different story. But
I love Priest and Ozzy, and I turned out fine, you know.
Me too. I didn't kill anybody. Not a soul.
Still fine.
Never would. Still,
not one, not even one person.
Yeah, this has been kind of, well, has been eye-opening in that a lot of the stuff that's, that exists about this case, these cases, is really wrong. It's really wrong.
I don't know how it got so wrong.
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff that I really wanted to clear up was he actually sexually abused? There's really no concrete evidence that can prove that. So that's got to be corrected. That's a lot of the basis for his behavior, for people to believe this is why he was so bad. Oh, he was treated terribly. His own father abused him sexually and psychologically and physically. Well, of course, that's why. And then he went to a doctor and the doctor gave him a bad touch. And we don't know.
The closest thing we got to it is Dan's biological dad, Claude, was a rapist. So this young boy learns about his dad sexually assaulting a woman on the street. I mean, that might have an effect on him, but that's the closest thing you can get to kind of sexual assault from a young age. But yeah, there you go.
The Claude LaPlante man has passed.
He died 20 years ago, 2006. Oh. He was a deeply troubled man, alcoholic.
That does do something. You know, Daniel LaPlante being in the presence of somebody who was so shitty, that proclivity for his porn obsession, addiction, if that's what Daniel LaPlante had, I don't know, but that's all relative.
He always had a porno mag in his bag, never seen without one. Dan was like feeling up women in the at the Townsend Commons, and every time he got to a party, him and his friends would really go too far and pull women's skirts up, and had no shame.
He was said to be very, very weird, very inappropriate. So let's keep in touch.
Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
You send me some things, and let's just figure out when you're going to be here.
Awesome. Please. I'll speak to you soon then.
Thank you. Well, that sure is something. I'm still taking this all in. The fact that there's no evidence of Daniel LaPlante being sexually abused. Every single story about Daniel LaPlante and his crimes says that he was sexually abused by his father. Some stories say his stepfather, and most stories say a psychiatrist that he was sent to. According to Joe Turner's research for his book, none of that can be corroborated. Daniel LaPlante did not know that his father was not his natural father. And to this day, Daniel LaPlante's mother does not think that he did any of these very serious crimes that he is in prison for. Joe Turner shared some photographs, some unseen photographs from the case. I have posted them online at crimeofthetruestkind.com. It is a bizarre case, and is made famous as the boy in the walls, which is the name of Joe Turner's forthcoming book, The Boy in the Walls, by Joe Turner, about Daniel LaPlante of Townsend, Massachusetts, and his crimes. Thank you for listening. My name is Angele Wood. This is Crime of the Truest Kind. Online, crimeofthetruestkind.com. Follow the show at Crime of the Truest Kind. My next live show, Thursday, March 7th, off Cabot, Beverly, Massachusetts. I do have a special guest. Brandy from Evaporate the Missing is going to join me when we talk about missing persons and advocacy. Regular everyday people can advocate for families affected by crime. Yes, please drop a 5-star review. Become a patron. 4 tiers starting at just $1. I dropped another monthly mini for February. This month's about Evelyn McHale, also known as the most beautiful suicide. I feel like there are other things I need to tell you. Thanks to all the Patreon folks, Lisa McColgan, Rhiannon, Superstar EPs, and all of you fine folks. All right, I must be going. And like I always say, and I said it again in this episode, lock your goddamn doors.